Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to the Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, welcome. I'm Dr. Deborah.
Hi, it's Therapist Kelly.
Okay, I brought you your chocolate. Was it a good day?
I love you. Like, I don't even know, like, how to convey that enough. You're the best. And if you want to rip it right open, because I know you like it too. Can we do it?
Yeah.
Okay. She's like, no, at the end of the show.
It's the badass chocolate.
Oh, so good. It's so good.
You are one of the few people, though, that I have encountered who like it that dark.
Really? So it's rare.
It's rare. Yeah, because you'll go like 92% dark chocolate.
I probably would. Yeah. Now, my go-to is about 85.
Well, that's what that is.
Exactly. Yeah. Maybe 87, but I will go higher.
You will.
Yeah, exactly. White, I will never do white. That's like the anti-chocolate. That is like...
I think it is the anti-chocolate.
It's not even
chocolate. It doesn't even taste like chocolate.
No. I was reading about it the other day. It's just cocoa butter. It's like there's no cocoa in it at all. So it's the fake chocolate.
The fake chocolate, yes.
But anyway, but thank you. That was so sweet. So how was the vineyard?
Oh, there was this wine that they have at that wine club that we belong to that we just love. Just absolutely love. And so we bought a couple of extra cases of it just to have it around for special.
You know what
occasions.
I'm gonna do one day? I'm gonna blindfold you.
Uh-huh.
I'm gonna put out like a rosé, a red, like a Sauvignon Blanc. I don't even know the names. I'm gonna make them up. But like, and I wanna see, like, I bet you will be so good. Like, I guarantee you'll be like, oh yeah, that has a hint of floral with a Cabernet whatever.
You know, the truth is I'm not that good at identifying the actual flavors that, let's say, a winemaker do at all. What I'm really good at is picking things that your average person is going to like a lot.
That makes sense.
So that's what makes me like a good focus group for a wine tasting place to say, give it to Deborah. If she likes it,
then
most
like
people
it.
Are going to, it's going to sell.
That's so interesting. But I bet you could still identify. I don't believe that. Like, I feel like you're good.
Happy to try it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometime. We'll go camping and we'll...
It'll be so much fun just to do the test.
So much fun.
I swear to God, I wouldn't even know. You put beer in front of me and wine, I'd be like, I don't know. I don't know the difference.
Your husband is the most hysterical person on the planet.
When he was doing the shots.
Wine tasting and he shot it like it was a shot of tequila.
Well, let me explain. Christopher was like inspecting like how it was going on the sides, sniffing. Like, it was so funny. And then David...
Chug.
It was
where's
just,
your wine? Oh, I didn't know I was supposed to sip it. He
is hysterical. It was like, I just put it down the quickest way I knew how. So funny.
So funny. So how are you?
Everything's okay. We went to Legoland yesterday, which was actually really fun.
Oh, nice.
Yes. Yeah, so the kids are off school. And
you drove all the way down to Legoland in the same day?
You know, it's really not that bad. On the way there, it only took us an hour and a half. It wasn't
that's
that
not
bad.
Bad at all.
It wasn't bad. It was Carlsbad, so it's like 30 minutes north of San Diego. But it wasn't that bad, you know. On the way home was a little bit harder, but it really, it feels like, you know, an easy trip to me.
Now, how old do you think it'll be before your older one does not like that kind of thing anymore?
He's 80.
He's now 8.
I say 80. I think he'll like it for a long time.
Oh, up until he's 80? Okay. Do you like it?
My husband, who's, 44? And he like... got an annual pass. And I think that even if the kids were like, no, I don't want one, he would get one for himself.
Oh my gosh, yes,
that's what you're dealing with here. Yeah.
Has it grown? Because I haven't been there in, I'm going to say, like 17 years.
That's a good question. It's wonderful. It's not so big where you're like, oh my God, like Disney is too much for me.
Okay.
I feel like there's too much going on. And Universal I like a lot because it's a little smaller. And I really like Legoland. It's not as like, crazy. I don't know.
Now, your kids are too young for Magic Mountain, right? Because they wouldn't benefit from all those amazing
roller
rides.
Coasters. Yeah, that's it. They love roller coasters, though.
I think that London will be too small to get on most of them, and then he'll be temper tantruming the whole time.
We don't want that. We'll stick with Legoland. Exactly.
But eventually, I haven't been there in a long time either.
Do they still have that?
Magic Mountain?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
They have literally, I'd say, like the best roller coasters on the planet.
Really?
I love roller coasters.
Me too. So do
and
I.
There's plenty of them
there.
I
remember there was one like that was in the dark. Is that the one?
They have some in the dark. They have some, you're upside down.
That's amazing.
You're twirling around. They're very hard on the back and the neck, though.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody with back and neck problems.
Yes,
like
I was
myself,
thinking that because my really neck careful. Hurt yesterday.
From Legoland.
Yeah, then we went on a couple roller coasters and it was like jolt, but I was also clenching because I was like, ah. But yeah, I felt it. I was like, damn, I'm getting old. You know, like every creak and nook and cranny I feel. So what about so you? Funny.
What about me? Kind of a chill weekend. I worked on Saturday, and then I had a meeting with some partners on some properties. And I'm trying to think. We just took a nice drive up to Santa Barbara on Sunday and had a couple over for dinner on Sunday night.
Aww, that's my kind of night. That sounds good. Really good. Cool. All right, so should we talk about last week's guest?
Okay. Do it.
So Corinne Zupko, From Anxiety to Love, A Radical New Approach for Letting Go of Fear and Finding Lasting Peace. And I really love this because it was a different take for me on anxiety. She studied The Course of Miracles, and I had heard about that in the past. And so I've been looking more into that, actually. But I really love that because it was sort of this spiritual approach to anxiety, which I really appreciated, rather than kind of, I guess, traditional methods. So it was a nice accent, I should say.
Yeah, and I like the way she juxtaposed love and anxiety, right?
Yes.
Because usually you think of anxiety versus peace, right? Peace is part of the title, but she really was talking about it from the love standpoint and the, you know, the simplicity of emotions when we don't complicate them.
Well, I thought when I originally read the title, I thought it was like finding the one, you know, with love. Like that's how I interpreted it. So it was interesting that like it kind of makes you change your lens on things.
Absolutely. So if you missed that show, please look her up and look up her book. And today we have Donald Altman, the author of Mindfulness Code and Clearing Emotional Clutter, and several other books about mindfulness. He is practicing psychotherapist and former Buddhist monk. Very interesting. An award-winning writer and an expert on mindful eating. He teaches in the neurobiology program of Portland State University. And welcome, Donald.
Oh, well, welcome. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with both of you today.
Well, thank you so much. And I want to mention the subtitle of this book, The Mindfulness Code. It's Keys for Overcoming Stress, Anxiety, Fear, and Unhappiness. So it's like a perfect segue from last week's show.
Yes.
Well, yeah, it kind of sounds like it, which is great. I mean, we're overcome so much with anxiety. I believe it's over 40 million people in this country who have some diagnosable anxiety issues. So we need help, don't we, to learn how to cope in new ways.
We do. And, you know, I'd love it, too, if you gave us your definition of anxiety as opposed to fear.
A definition of
anxiety, she said.
Anxiety?
Yeah,
you know,
well, so
I see anxiety as having not really having a really good relationship with your thoughts and your mind, because I think it's very normal for us. We have an ancient system in us which triggers protective perceptions very quickly. So, you know, in our ancient brain, we were designed to respond with the stress response. We heard a tiger in the jungle, but today it's getting on the freeway for an 8 a.m., you know, going to work at 8 a.m. in the morning, or going into a meeting and hearing anybody say anything that might be triggering or that we could take in a defensive way. So this ancient system is really kind of at odds with the life we lead today, but it's very normal for us to get triggered very quickly. And so what I try to help people do is to use mindfulness as a tool to constructively distance from those anxious thoughts, those negative ruminating thoughts, and so on, and make our mind more our friend. Could I tell you one little story about somebody who I worked with in that way?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I worked with a gentleman who, he was having anxiety attacks every day. Now, bear in mind, his father had died at a very young age, and so of a heart attack. But he would hyper-focus on bodily sensations, especially while he was driving, which is stressful anyway, right? He's in transition. You're moving from one place to another. You don't know what's going to happen. Your body, your anxiety levels tend to rise during transitional periods. So there he was in the car, and he'd hyper-focus on maybe his palms were getting a little clammy, or, you know, he felt some other sensation, and he'd impose a catastrophizing thought on that sensation, oh my God, this must be the beginning of that heart attack like my dad had, right? Mm-hmm. And he would escalate up into an anxiety attack. What I worked with him on was kind of twofold. One, I helped him start to notice the thoughts and not to grab onto those thoughts or identify with them too strongly. The average person has about 75,000 thoughts in the course of a day. And I'd like your listeners to ask themselves this question. How many of those 75,000 thoughts tell me something really profound about who I am?
That's a good question.
Right? How many are maybe just toxic thoughts, automatic thoughts, conditioned mm-hmm. thoughts, and that aren't really truthful or right. accurate? So we need to start to understand that just because thoughts come from within our own head doesn't mean that they're more accurate or that we have to take them more seriously than maybe other thoughts. So mm-hmm. that's the first way I worked with them. The second way was to get them into the body. And maybe a little later today I can guide you through a nice stress-reducing body relaxation that is a wonderful way to kind of get into the body. And research shows that when you get into the body, you actually kind of pull the plug on that default mode network of the brain. It's constantly spinning stories. If you're not working on anything that's outcome-oriented, task-oriented, your mind will just start spinning stories, and often distressing ones or distressing emotions will appear. So getting into the body kind of pulls the plug on that. So I had him do both of those things, and eventually he was able to realize that the thought he was having about the, what was happening in his body, those were two different, they were related, but two very different phenomena. And he was able to, when he would hear those thoughts come in, he eventually was able to say, oh, hello again, old friend. Mm-hmm. Imagine that he was able to actually look at those thoughts, not resist or fight them. And that's where a lot of our suffering comes in. Mindfulness is really, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly, it's really a way of finding a sense of equanimity, a sense of peace in the yeah. world, peace within, and finding peace without with others. And, you mentioned that love was a topic last week. And I think that is a key part of mindfulness, too, is learning how to make the heart grow more tender, but to help us not have to be so reactive to anxiety and to help reduce our suffering in this world. I think we're here to find joy. We're not here to find suffering necessarily, right?
Well, I love your definition of mindfulness because it's pretty simple. I guess my question to you is, why do you feel people are so resistant to it? I think in our society in general, it's like we're waiting in line and you see mm-hmm. everybody on their phone. It's like they want to escape. They don't want to be in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm curious your thoughts.
It's really interesting, isn't it? I think it's a way of, we're so distractible. And technology, by the way, I really think it's very beneficial. It can add a lot to our lives. But at the same time, we need to know how to create boundaries, healthy boundaries with it that can help us actually so that we can connect more with others. There's a mindfulness part of the brain. If you were to touch the eyebrow ridge right now, you're touching that right behind that is the prefrontal cortex, and that's the part of the brain. And there's a lot of brain information in this in the mindfulness code book. I want people to understand that we are wired to use mindfulness. And so mm-hmm. that area, the prefrontal cortex, has many different functions related to empathy and pausing and reflecting and allowing us to slow down. It also is the social connection part of the brain. It wires up in the first 10 to 24 months of life mm-hmm. and it with our caregivers. It's the face-to-face, the kind of eyeball-to-eyeball connection. It helps mm-hmm. wire that up. And I like to make the point that if somebody, maybe you didn't have the best caregivers, maybe you don't feel like you could trust or that you could get close to people. If there were deficits in that part of the brain, it doesn't mean that it stops wiring. Mm-hmm. So you can continue to help that part of the brain wire up. And even when, somebody's working with either of you in the therapy room and you create a safe space for them and a place for them to connect with you, you're allowing them to continue to wire up that part of the brain. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a very hopeful message that we are built for that kind of connection. And there's even a fascinating study where there were young kids who they were tested for their ability to notice facial recognition and their ability to recognize emotions in others, and they tested very low. These were preteens. Mm. They were taken away to an outdoor camp, and for 5 days they took their screens away. Because the average 18-year-old, they must have been consternation over that. But yes. The average 18-year-old, the Kaiser Family Foundation found that age range spends over seven and a half hours a day looking at screens. And so they took their screens away, and during that week they had to interact face-to-face with their peers. And then they were retested at the end of those 5 days, and it was beautiful to see they regain that ability to recognize facial expression, emotion, body language. And so, we can see that technology may mute that ability, but it's built into us, and it can come back very quickly. So I think it's important to, I actually have people I work with do a technology intake with them to see how much time are they spending with technology at work every day, at home, how much uninterrupted face-to-face time with a significant other in their life. And it was great to hear how you two were talking about how you spent your weekend, and it was so interpersonal.
Mm-hmm.
I loved it because you were spending that time face-to-face, and there's really no way to duplicate that other than just to spend that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we need to help people become more aware. One lady, one time when I asked her, how much uninterrupted FaceTime you have with your partner, she said, well, can I count the time during the commercial when I put the TV on mute?
Wow.
I mean, that's all the time, apparently, that she got, with that significant person in her life. So it's something that we need to think more about. But that's a great question you ask. I mean, it's easy for us to get drawn in, and I see it all the time, and because I travel a lot in airports, or I see families walking to restaurants and they're all on their devices. They're not interacting with each other. Maybe they're sending each other text messages, and I don't know, but kind of interesting.
I am so glad that you bring up, though, the resiliency of who we are as humans and our ability to grow regardless of the deficits we may have experienced in our childhood. Because I think so many people, they get caught up in that victim mentality and believe that, well, I didn't get it then, I'm screwed for life.
Mm-hmm.
And, to really know that even studies and research shows that. And you know what I find to be the most annoying thing about social media these days or texting and stuff? It's my fear of hurting somebody's feelings if I don't respond back to them really quickly. Like you once said to me that you turn your phone off at a certain period, and it's pretty early at night, and you just do that.
Yep.
And I feel like people are so used to being able to text me and stuff at 9 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night or on a Sunday, or I'm trying to figure out my schedule because somebody's made a change, and then I feel like, okay, I'm going to turn this off. I don't want to talk to anybody in this way,
right?
But then I'm like, oh, they're gonna think that I'm mad, they'll think that I'm not available, so that's causing me more anxiety than any other aspect of social media.
It's interesting. Yeah, I worked in an intensive outpatient eating disorder clinic for several years, and so we had some younger people in that clinic who if somebody texted them at 2 a.m. they would instantly text back.
Mm-hmm.
And we were always trying to get them to guard their sleep, and sleep is so critical in so many different ways.
Right.
But they felt that they, that they'd be judged very harshly if they didn't do that. So I think that, I think there's kind of a backlash now to technology where people are starting to say, I deserve to have that slow time. And, and people are starting to understand, even in cars where, many states now have laws. I don't know, here in Oregon, you cannot even hold a cell phone in your hand anymore. You get a ticket. So I don't know if that's the case in California.
Same.
Yeah,
very strict, which is good.
Yeah, so I think people are understanding that, you need to have, kind of a separation at certain times. And there was, in fact, in New York City, there was a group of people who used to love reading novels, and they noticed that because of all their, cell phone and Facebook, whatever, they just had kind of lost the ability to just sit down.
Yeah.
And read a novel. And so they created a slow reading group, and they would go to one person's house and, several of them together, and they'd put all their phones in a basket and shut them off, and then they would all sit as a group and just read for an hour or two. And maybe talk about what they were reading, but it was kind of neat that people are trying to rediscover what we've lost.
Exactly. What I'm thinking, Dr. Deborah, as you were talking, what if you could create some sort of automatic email reply that says, you know, I've now turned my, you know, email and phone off at 8 p.m., you know, please note that I will respond in 24 hours or something. So at least you're letting them know, hey, I'm not ignoring you. I'm just, you know, and it's good modeling for these people, too.
Another task for Christopher.
Yeah, you know what? That's a great idea. I never thought it would happen to me, and I'll fess up that when I started texting, I didn't do it for a long time. When I finally started, I noticed that when somebody didn't get to me, I'd have what I call textpectation.
I love that. Yes.
That's my word for it. You know, it's like I'm sitting there with this kind of, you know, anticipation, and I just have learned, you know, I've got to just, that's a great time for me to just breathe out and let it go.
So we are talking with Donald Altman. He is the author of The Mindfulness Code. So let's talk a little bit about stress, because I think we all can relate it to that.
What are you talking about? What are you talking about?
Exactly.
What's stress?
So how bad is stress for us? I mean, I know a little bit of stress is good, but
Yeah, it is very injurious to our immune system, for one thing. So when you get stressed out, your body sends a cascade very quickly of stress hormones into the body. So it lowers your what are called your T cells, right, for fighting different kinds of illnesses. It lowers your NK cell count. NK cells are natural killer cells, and those are very important cells because they're implicated in preventing tumors and even some kinds of viruses. In addition, cortisol is the main culprit. Cortisol will flood the brain. Not just the body, but floods the brain, and it actually will kill cells in what is an area called the hippocampus, which is the learning part of the brain. So stress makes it harder for us to learn. Mm-hmm. And then in addition, stress is implicated with obesity. What happens is when you're stressful and you have a lot of cortisol, that cortisol needs to be cleared out of the body. Well, guess what helps clear it out? Fat. So you will crave fatty foods, and this is stored in an organ that kind of hangs off the abdomen called the omentum or the greater omentum. And the greater omentum will wrap around the abdomen. So people that have a large, you know, the girth, your girth is more of a health issue than just your weight per se. So that omentum will wrap around the abdominal area. And so that the fat that's there is used both for instant energy, if you're, you know, if you're doing something very, you know, that requires instant mobilization, or but also to clear out cortisol. So also, you know, and so it's so there are even diabetes, I believe, is implicated in stress. There are a lot of health issues. So it's pretty dramatic when you think about the damage of stress. Then there's the stress, the damage of just carrying stress home with you.
Right.
And so there have been studies done by the American Psychological Association, for example, where they show that two out of every three, you can find this online, it's the American Psychological Association Survey of Stress in America, and two out of every three persons has either a psychological or a physical symptom of stress. Over a third of those people eat unhealthfully, and another third act out poorly in terms of those in their household.
Wow.
So either abusively or just not being able to, you know, calm themselves down after a stressful day, and they carry it into the household. So there are, a lot, you know, huge, and then there's burnout, too.
Yeah.
It's another type of stress that happens in the workplace. So it's a major issue, you know, when you think about 8 of 10 medications, for example, that are prescribed are for symptoms of stress. So that's why I like mindfulness. It's kind of an all-natural solution, all-natural approach to dealing with these issues. So, I'm glad you asked that question, because stress affects us so in so many ways.
I am so gray in my hair, and I'm wondering, like, what's the correlation? Like, is it true that, you know, does gray hair equal stress?
Well, Well, I don't know about gray hair, but I know that stress, even stressful thoughts, even anxious thoughts, can shorten. It's the end of our chromosomes. There's a little. The end of it is called a telomere.
Telomeres
are biological. Biological markers of aging. Have you heard of those?
Yes, we had an author of telomere effect. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's been shown that that even stressful thoughts can prematurely shorten telomeres. But the good news is that there's evidence for the first time that a health style intervention, a lifestyle intervention, can reverse that. And actually, telomeres have been shown to increase in length for the first time. So by eating more unprocessed foods, getting exercise, having peer-to-peer, time with other people, and then doing mindfulness and relaxation-type practices, those have been the four elements that have been shown to actually help telomeres. Protect them and keep them from early dwindling, so to speak.
So why don't we just do a little mindfulness and give our audience a taste of what we're in for?
Oh, okay. Great. This is what I call palm the present moment. And it's a very nice way to get present using the body, getting physical. Some might call it a physical grounding method. If you're driving, you might want to just adapt it and squeeze the steering wheel a little tighter with your hands instead of pressing your hands together like we're going to do here. I would not advise necessarily doing this in a car. Mm-hmm. So you might want to just listen in later to your, you have an archive, right? And so people could do it then. So I want you to follow along if you can. So what we're going to do here is I want you to just get present in the body. Notice your feet on the floor and just press your feet a little bit into the floor. Get rooted and grounded like your favorite tree or plant. Wonderful. Just notice where your body's making contact in the chair. So we're just getting into the body. And this is going to be a very simple process of bringing our palms together. But to begin, I want you to rub your palms together for about 5 seconds, maybe a little bit longer, 5-10 seconds at most, just to build up a little heat between the palms. Just notice what that feels like. Great. And now raise your hands up about a foot or foot and a half apart. And now what we're going to do is I'm going to guide you to very slowly move your palms closer until your fingers and then palms touch. But I'm going to do it in a way that you're going to notice maybe some very, very subtle sensations. So now let's just start bringing the palms very closer together. But I want you to pause at the moment you sense even the slightest heat, warmth, energy, or pressure between the palms, and it might be very subtle, but I want you to pause there and just notice what that sensation is. And you might think of it as a ball or a sphere that you're kind of holding. Just notice how big that is as you're holding that. And now just slowly continue to move the palms closer together. And you're going to go until just the fingertips touch. And there's no race here. We're not in a race. I like to say that life is not a race, but a place to find grace. So just slowly bring your hands closer together. Some people report that they almost feel like they have to push against that heat, warmth, energy, or pressure. And you might notice that changing as the palms get closer. But you're going to go until just the fingertips have a light, feathery touch between them. Okay. And just notice what that feels like for a moment. And once your fingertips are touching, now you're going to continue to slowly bring the palms together. And I want you to notice as you do this, how do the fingers straighten up? How does the positioning of the wrist change? And what parts of the hand come into contact even before the palms touch? Because the palms don't touch first. Different parts of the hand will come into contact. So I want you to be acutely aware. Bring your attention to all of those fine movements until your palms come together and touch. Give you a few more seconds to do that. And when your palms are touching, I like to ask this rhetorical question. Is what you're experiencing right now, is this yesterday? Is this tomorrow? That's very much the present moment, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The here and now. Great. So So now with your palms touching, I want you to raise your elbows up out to the side. We're going to do a little bit of progressive relaxation right here, progressive muscle relaxation. It's a nice way to let go of stress. So I want you to press with maybe about 10% of pressure and only go as far as you can without having any pain. I want to make sure all of your audience knows that. If, you know, everybody has a little different pain threshold or different, you know, flexibility in the joints. So I want you to only go as far as you can. And if you can, let's press even a little harder, maybe 15 to 20% of pressure, just noticing where the tension goes. Does it go up the wrists, the elbows, the shoulders, the back, the chest? You might feel some muscle fatigue. And now let's count down from the count of 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Keeping the palms together, let's let the elbows come down, let the shoulders relax and come down, just releasing some of that tension. Feeling how nice it is to let go and relax and release. We could even take a nice breath in now. I want you to even visualize taking a nice breath in, picturing that breath go to any part of the body where there's remaining tension, tightness, or even negativity or anxiety, and just exhale it out. Let the breath do it. Let the breath carry it away as you exhale. You can see the breath carrying it down, down the body, out, down the legs, and down through the bottom of the feet and back into the earth for recycling. Let's take another nice one or two of these harmonizing, centering breaths, breathing in, letting the breath remove any remaining tension, tightness, or even negativity, and exhaling it out down through the bottom of the feet and back into the earth, which is large enough to hold all of that. And with, as you exhale, you might notice that part of the body relaxing a little bit more, letting go a little bit more. And now we can just sit in the presence of the body for a few more moments, the body, this precious gift that carries our consciousness and helps us do so much and accomplish so much in the course of a day. I like to think that we can even send our inner healing smile, and I talk about that in the mindfulness code, just breathing in and picturing the inner healing smile, maybe having kind of a Mona Lisa smile on your lips as you're smiling inwardly in gratitude for what the whole body does for you on a daily basis, and just picturing that warm glow of gratitude filling up all the cells of your body right now. How wonderful. And take a nice breath. Exhale. And to conclude this, you can roll your shoulders around if you want. You can move your head from side to side. And then let's take one nice long breath as we raise our arms up. A morning or afternoon stretch, whatever you prefer, raising your arms up high like the sun rising in the morning sky and exhaling as you lower the arms down at your side. We did this over a period of a few minutes, but you could even do this as a brief 1 minute stress reduction palm the present moment practice.
Yoga nap.
I know. I feel like taking a little nap. That was beautiful.
I wondered if you're still going to be there.
Yeah, exactly. Silence. Crickets.
Didn't set the alarm. Ding, ding. Wake up. Wake right. up, ladies. That was beautiful.
It was absolutely beautiful.
So first, I felt like when I was putting my hands together, I felt like I was pushing through peanut butter.
Interesting.
Oh, interesting.
Like they were,
you know,
a
lot of people are surprised if they sense
what's that?
That something, yeah, something between the palms, an energy or something, yeah.
Yeah, it was. It was actually kind of profound.
Oh, that's neat. That's great.
I felt a lot of heat.
Heat?
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't
okay.
expect to,
yeah.
Which is
and
nice.
That's one reason I want people to kind of rub their hands together just to kind of get them ready for that, because the hands are very sensitive. There's actually more neural real estate in the brain devoted to the hands than any other part of the body.
Oh,
so
really?
It's nice to kind of feel the warmth, and if you really sit and are present, you might even notice your heartbeat as it pulsates in the palm or even tingles in your fingertips.
Mm.
So even as you're holding your palms just gently together, you might even notice that sensation as well.
Wow. Okay. Let's come back to ourselves here.
I know. We're off in La La Land.
So I have a lot of different guided meditations like that in the book, actually.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, you know, I was wondering, could you share a little bit about the connection to mindfulness and healing from eating disorders and addictions? Because I know you do a lot of food, and that's such a big field.
Well, it is a big thing. And what happens when you're Mindfulness almost acts as kind of a different way of observing cravings or impulsive reactivity, in which you're able to start curiously observing what's happening. And so let's say you're having, for example, I'll share an example of somebody I worked with who had was relapsing from her eating disorder. And so I would have her breathe when she wasn't, she would actually binge eat this particular person. Mm-hmm. I would have her, I'd say, when you're ready to go into the break room and you think you want to binge eat, I want you just for 1 minute to do the diaphragmatic breathing that I teach, and that's in that book also. I just had her put her arms behind her back and, you know, and clasp her hands together and just breathe for 1 minute. And what she came back to me, and she said, wow, she said, that was amazing. She said, he said, only half the time after 1 minute did I go back, I'll go and eat that food. The other 50% of the time, I just went on with my day. And so I said, okay, now the next time I want you to do an additional minute. If you still feel like you want to have that food, do one more minute. But what we were doing with that practice, I was turning her away from the food, turning her attention mm-hmm. toward the breath. I was delaying the action of the impulsive the eating of the food, the compulsive eating, or delaying it. But I was also allowing her then to regulate through the breath to bring herself into an emotionally calm, regulated state. Because this particular kind of breathing, which I'm sure you know this, and is turns on the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the relaxation system of the body, and it helps you regulate. And so mindfulness also... I mean, I also have clients observe their craving.
Wait, Donald, hang on 1 second. We seem to have a caller.
Yes. Hi, you're on live with Dr. Deborah and therapist Kelly.
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Hey, my name is David. I have a question for today's speaker, today's guest.
Sure. Let me see if I can merge you guys. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
I had a question earlier about the guest comments regarding a lifestyle change and the ability to slow the aging process.
Sure.
The question is, how long after the lifestyle change would someone start seeing the effects of, or start seeing the positive effects?
Donald, are you still there? I have such problems with merging this. Okay, hold on. Let me see if he's...
Donald?
Is he still there? Donald, can you hear us?
Did we lose him?
It looks like he's there. Hold on, let me see. Okay, hold
very
on.
Important.
Donald, are you still
when
there?
Working with those problems.
Donald, are you still there?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you hear the caller's question?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I didn't hear that.
Okay,
oh, okay.
Hang on 1 second.
Can you hear... Okay, David, meet Donald.
Wait, let me see if David's still there. Hold on.
Well, I can barely hear it. David, I'm sorry. You'll have to repeat David's question for me, I guess.
Sure. So David had asked, how soon after making a lifestyle change would someone notice the benefits, the positive benefits of that, when you were talking about telomeres and such?
Yeah. Well, in terms of telomeres, that was a very intense, that was a five-year pilot program, actually. So,
right. So, David, sorry, we got you
something that maybe took a longer period of time, but at least you wouldn't be diminishing your, actually, there was another study that showed even 3 months of doing meditative practices acted as a buffer against shortening telomeres.
So, David, were you able to hear the beginning part of that?
I did. I what I heard was even 3 months of meditative practices could start reducing the aging process or reducing the shortening of.
Okay. That's right. I can hear you now. I can hear David now. Yeah, that's right, David. Just so it was shown that 3 months was actually they tested people before and after, and the telomere process had slowed down. After 3 months of meditation.
And then meditation, in addition to the other lifestyle changes, such as a healthier diet, more peer-to-peer contact, how would you answer the same question, but without the meditative practices, but with the diet and the social changes?
The research that had the diet and the social changes also included meditative relaxation practices, but not maybe it wasn't meditation per se. No, but I think any combination of those would be good. And I want you to just see how are you handling stress as you start to do these practices. But I think the more of those you could do, the better, obviously, I think it would be.
Well, then, Kelly.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah,
thank you so much for the call.
Thanks for the call. Kelly, that means you're probably like 12.
in my telomeres. But then I have my all additional stresses in my life, so it probably evens out. So it's like I do my meditation, but then I have my other stress.
Great. Okay, so we're back. We were on the topic of eating disorders and the things that you do using mindfulness to help people. And I love that. So the 1 minute and then adding another minute to help to reduce those cravings. And does that work with drugs and alcohol as well?
Yeah, that would act as an interrupter. I have it's actually in another one of my books. It's in a book called The Mindfulness Toolbox. And I have a portable method called STOP that actually helps people pause anytime that they feel that they're kind of ready to react to a craving of any kind or negativity. And I've had people use this under many, many different circumstances. I have had clients, for example, who would get triggered into compulsive eating and compulsive shopping going into a Costco store, for example.
I know that one.
I could do this right in the store or outside of the store. And it really regulates you and activates the prefrontal cortex, and you can do it in about a minute or two, and nobody even knows you're doing it.
Wow, that's great.
It's a powerful tool. I like it. So doable, right?
And so
it just requires yourself and the ability to count to 60.
And, if you practice it and do it before you get triggered, then it's even better because you'll remember to do it. Mm-hmm. And you'll have experience having, with any of the mindfulness things, I think the practice is an important part of it. I teach it in my office and people kind of, that's nice. But if they don't practice it, you may not remember it, when you get triggered in the moment. So I'm always trying to get people to think about how could they integrate this into their lives.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. People have such resistance to practicing this on an ongoing basis, and then they wait until the time when they're all stressed out and they want to calm down, and it's so much harder to calm down when you're already revved up.
Yes.
So it's such an important point.
That's true. The nice thing about mindfulness is you can be mindful as you're going throughout your day, not having to do an extra thing, so to speak, but you can actually practice. We have to breathe anyway, don't we? Hopefully we keep, I heard somebody say the cause of all death was that all those people who died failed to take one extra breath.
Mm. Oh,
wow.
But we all have to breathe anyway, but we can breathe in a way that really sustains us and helps us. Mm-hmm. And we can notice when we're getting reactive. I mean, when I was younger, I would get very reactive when I was driving in the car So that, it's very different now. I observe it, and I don't have to hang on to it. And it's kind of, I think mindfulness really rewires your brain in a very powerful way in just a brief period. If you do this for just a few minutes a day, it really starts to rewire the brain.
I believe it.
Absolutely.
I have a question for you personally. Were you always pretty calm and relaxed, or were you sort of stressed out and then it kind of led you into this path?
Yeah, I think I was kind of stressed out, and that led me into this path.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm much more calmer now.
You sound
and it.
It
doesn't
like
mean that I don't get reactive. I still do. I'd be in the airport and something happens and I'll notice it, and then I'll just say, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And I'm able to just be present with it and not resist it. I think a lot of our suffering comes from resisting what's happening to us in this moment.
Yes.
And, one time I had a real busy day. I was at my office, and I remember this, and I had a cancellation. I wasn't feeling as focused as I wanted to with clients. So I thought I'll walk down. There was a river, was just about 3 blocks from my office, and I walked down there. I started doing mindfulness walking meditation, and it was cold. I felt the cold air on me, and I had this thought that, you know, oh, this is, you know, I don't like this. This is unpleasant. But I kept walking, and then there was a park right nearby, and kids were playing, and then again when, you know, they were, you know, yelling and having fun, but my mind jumped in right away, and it said, you know, these kids are so noisy, they're ruining my perfect walking meditation.
Yep.
And in that moment, what I call a mind whisper, we have these very subtle intentions that come by, and this mind whisper came by very quickly, and it said, oh, go back to the office, it's warmer, quieter there. And if we're not careful, folks, you know, we can almost act robotically. And I started to turn just like a robot following that intention, but then I caught it, and I remember I started to laugh, and, oh, so this moment isn't good enough.
Mm.
And I'm going to reject it for somewhere else.
Yes.
Right. And so I stayed, and I let in the sounds from the kid. I let in the cold air, and I was just more present, had a wonderful walking meditation. So I think what we can do in our life is not just to try to avoid all those things that conditions before us, but let it in. But let it in with a kind of openness and a kind of acceptance for it, and being present with it. And mindfulness doesn't try to avoid or escape. It's about really facing what's in our life right now. And I think that can be very healing, actually.
It's so funny. For some reason, when you were talking about that, it was bringing me to one of my little pet peeves that I now just sort of observe, and I think it's interesting. It's like going to the movies on a Saturday midday, a children's movie, and being annoyed at the children laughing and squealing and running around, right? It's like, why would you go then and be annoyed? Go and embrace the joy of these little beings, these little rascals, enjoying themselves.
Sure.
You know, but you see these people going, shh, tell your kids to be quiet. So, no, this is a kid's movie, you know?
Right.
We're here. We're intruding on their space. Yeah. They're not intruding on our space.
Yeah, and that's the beauty, I think, of mindfulness. Is the one aspect that I didn't really mention here is that it helps us understand suffering. It helps us understand what causes suffering in our lives. And so let's say even, you know, you're in a relationship with somebody, they're not doing things the way you want them to do, like those kids weren't, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that creates suffering when you realize they're just being who they are. And if you can let it be, and accept that, and instead of trying to impose your, you know, your shoulds, you know, you should be, things should be like this, then you reduce your own suffering in the moment. That's very powerful. And also noticing that other people's suffering might be overflowing on you. It might be spilling over on you. And just noticing, okay, this, you know, nobody wants to be abused, and I'm not condoning that, but I'm saying that we could start to understand even the behavior of others is a form of their suffering. And once we can recognize that, it frees us up. Mm-hmm. It frees us up from having to react and respond to that. We can be softer. We can start to understand, oh, you know, I've been there. I know what this suffering is like, too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You will be shocked. We are shocked, but we are running out of time. Can you believe that?
Wow.
We've been talking.
It's hard to believe. I've enjoyed being here with you.
So much fun. We're talking with Donald Altman, the author of The Mindfulness Code, Keys for Overcoming Stress, Anxiety, Fear, and Unhappiness. And where can people get the book and a website for you, please?
Well, they can get the book on Amazon or your other favorite online site. And also, you can go to my website, mindfulpractices.com. It's that's MINDFUL1L practices plural .com. I have a newsletter there too that has some monthly, it comes out, called the Mindful Living Newsletter. I invite you to sign up, and that'll tell you some of my new workshops and new books and so forth that are coming out, and also has a contemplation and a practice that you can use and work on mindfulness with.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Have a beautiful day.
Oh, well, thank you, Dr. Deborah and Therapist Kelly. Very much enjoyed it. Bless you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right. So our guest for next week had to cancel on us. So yes. We so are going to surprise, surprise, surprise.
To be determined.
TBD.
Yes. Yes.
All right, everybody, have a fantastic week. Thank you to our caller, and thank you for
listening.
Yes,
thank you so much. And also, our Instagram's doing pretty well. So I wanted to give a shout-out for our Instagram, at Dr. Debra, that's D-E-B-R-A, and Therapist Kelly with an I. And, we post different things on there, and it seems to be getting a nice following.
Yay.
So I'm excited.
Follow us some more.
Yes. All right, take care. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Dr. Debra and Therapist Kelly Show, only on LA Talk Radio.